I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax News listeners. On this edition of the program, we're going to be discussing U.S.-Iran relations from the 1953 CIA-backed coup of Mossadegh and the 1979 Iran hostage crisis to the Iran nuclear deal. We'll also be covering the state of U.S.-Iran relations today at this early stage in the Biden presidency. Joining us is Dr. Asal Rod of the National Iranian American Council. I consider her one of the most astute commentators on U.S.-Iran relations, and I think she provides a rather thoughtful critique of how the U.S. has handled foreign policy with regards to Iran. I hope that the following conversation will provide not only a useful primer on the history of U.S.-Iran relations, but also illuminate why discussion of this topic is so important. So, with that being said, let's get right to it with Dr. Asal Rod of the National Iranian American Council. Welcome to Parallax Views, Dr. Asal Rod of the National Iranian American Council. How are you doing today? And did I get the pronunciation right there?
Yes, I'm doing good. Thank you very much. And thank you for having me.
So I want to start with maybe telling listeners a little bit about yourself and about NIAC, in case they're unfamiliar.
Sure. So I'm Iranian American. I'm the child of Iranian immigrants. I was born and raised in the United States myself. And NIAC, the National Iranian American Council, is really a grassroots advocacy group that tries to empower the Iranian American community to participate in, you know, our elections and in civil society and the process of democracy in the United States. And of course, to address policy issues that specifically affect our community. So that's, you know, sort of the basic thing that NIAC does. Our focus is on equitable immigration, peace and diplomacy with Iran, which entails, you know, sanctions relief and avoiding war, and civil rights for all Americans.
And I also want to just get this out of the way because I can hear some troll saying this right now. Is it funded by the state of Iran? It isn't. And I think that's made very clear on the website.
Yes. If you know, go to the website, NIAC has been around for 20 years. It is a 501c3 organization in the United States. We are an American organization. We do not get funds from any government, and certainly not the Iranian government. Our funding comes through grants from American institutions and primarily through, you know, donations, individual donations by not just Iranian Americans, of course, that's the bulk of it, but also other American allies.
So where I wanted to start with this conversation is when it comes to U.S.-Iran relations, I think that there's a lot of long-term bad feelings or negative feelings that people have, both Iran towards the U.S. maybe and the U.S. towards Iran over things like the Iran hostage crisis or the 1953 coup against Mossadegh in Iran. Could you speak a little bit to those two things, maybe starting with the hostage crisis? Because I think it's really done a lot of damage to U.S.-Iran relations and moving forward with those relations.
Absolutely. I mean, from the United States' point of view, the embassy seizure of November 1979 is sort of the defining moment of contemporary relations with Iran. That's what defines it. And, you know, rightfully so, the United States has incredible grievances of the breach of diplomatic land, of land when you, you know, when you have an embassy in another country, that is supposed to be the sovereign soil of that country. And so that breach was a very, you know, significant breach of international law and relations between the United States and Iran. And of course, it was a significant humiliation for the United States to have hostages there for 444 days. The background to it, the historical background is, and you mentioned 1953, which is actually specifically where sort of this, the history that builds up to that moment. The concern of Iranians or the Iranian students who actually took the embassy was that the embassy would be used as a location to carry out another coup, as we saw in 1953. And so, you know, the revolution happened in February of 1979. The embassy seizure happened in November of 1979. And what you see happen between those two periods is 2 weeks before the embassy seizure, the President Carter of the United States allows the Shah into the United States. And this sort of becomes a signal on the Iranian side that raises red flags and concerns that there's another plot about. But there's something very interesting when you look at, you know, there's mutual grievances. There's 1953 is the lens through which Iranians see it. 1979 is the lens through which Americans see it. But John Qazvinyan just came out with a book called America and Iran. And it looks at the history of relations between these two nations over the last 300 years. And what's fascinating about the information that he puts forward is that we focus on these 2 days. We always focus on 1979 and 1953. And yet there's this vast history before that. And a lot of it is mutual admiration, where Iran was subject to colonial, the sort of colonial games of Russia and England in the 1800s and early 1900s. The US was not partaking in that in that direct colonialism in Iran at that time. And so in many ways, Iranians looked to the US as sort of savior, someone to help them. Not a savior is the wrong way of saying it, but someone who could help, especially given the ideals that we espouse in the United States. So yes, those are certainly significant mutual contemporary grievances. But when you look at the previous history, it also flies in the face of this idea that there's an inevitable adversarial relationship.
I also just wanted to add to that, for people that are unfamiliar with the 1953 coup, I mean, U.S. involvement in that coup through CIA's Operation Ajax, that's all confirmed. None of that is in contestation. And I think that it's important to look at that sort of Iranian perspective and say, hey, maybe this is why there is bad blood or paranoia when the Iranian hostage crisis happens. And I think sometimes there has been a lack of trying to understand the Iranian perspective on the part of Americans.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, because in fact, you know, there's a whole historical canon that looks at that period, looking through the archival research, and obviously the fact that it was a coup is sort of established history. But the CIA has released documents on the American side that have basically confirmed this. And in fact, U.S. officials have finally like admitted to this idea. And you have U.S. lawmakers, someone like Senator Bernie Sanders, who actually uses that exact point that you just made, which is, well, we have to also recognize our role in having brought about a certain historical trajectory for Iran once we removed the Iranian prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, and put in, or reimposed, I should say, a monarch who was a dictator. So that, you know, when you look at the historical trajectory of Iran and where Iran is today, that's a very important moment, historical moment to keep in mind.
I also wanted to ask, it just crossed my mind, and I think it would be of interest to listeners, why, when we get into maybe the war on terror era, the Bush era of the war on terror, why do we not have more diplomatic relations with Iran? I know there was a lot of attacking Iran, saying it was part of the axis of evil, but it would seem to me that a Shia majority country like Iran could be an ally against, Wahhabist or Salafist jihadists. Could you comment on that?
You know, when you look at the region, broadly speaking, Iran is a significant and historically has been a significant player in the region. And so when you have this sort of adversarial relationship with the United States, it really does affect our ability to fulfill the things that we at least we claim we want to fulfill, right? We want regional peace, we want regional stability. And yet without sort of coordinating with one of the central powers in the region, you know, that's going to be a daunting challenge to do so. And specifically when you talk about sort of where these alliances can be, you know, when Mohammad Khatami was the reformist president in Iran in the late 90s and early 2000s, there was signals from Iran to tell, sort of warn of the Taliban, because Afghanistan and Iran are neighboring countries. And the Taliban is anti-Shia. And of course, for Iran, as a majority Shia country, this was an important thing. They were interested in addressing the drugs that were coming into Iran through Afghanistan. There was all sorts of things where Iran was sort of warning, and that wasn't taken very seriously. In another case, years, you know, about a decade later, you look at the rise of ISIS in Iraq as a consequence of the US invasion of Iraq in 2003. And who again is fighting against ISIS? Iran, right? So we have mutual reasons to be fighting sort of mutual enemies. And yet when we can't do this in coordination, it creates more problems. Even right now, it would be so helpful to resolving the crisis in Yemen if you had some coordination between the US and Iran. And when we don't have those things, we just have continuous conflict. And it sort of falls into these similar patterns. But to your point, there are clearly times and indications where the US and Iran are fighting the same entity.
And I guess that brings us to the Iran deal, I believe it's the JCPOA?
The JCPOA, it's a mouthful, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action.
I just wanted to talk a little about what that deal did with regards to U.S.-Iran relations and the effect that it had on those relations and what happened when Trump, as president, sort of broke the deal.
Well, there's a few things that were important about the deal. In terms of U.S.-Iran relations, it was, you know, another sort of watershed moment. It was a historic moment because after decades of enmity, after decades of just belligerent rhetoric on both sides, you had the United States and Iran, along with the international community, sit down at a table and negotiate a peaceful negotiation, right? And that's, you know, when we talk about diplomacy, it's fascinating because diplomacy is really about how you can negotiate with your adversaries, not your friends, right? Your allies are very easy to agree with. That's why they're your allies. But real diplomacy, if we look at diplomacy as a way of avoiding conflict, right? Real diplomacy then works when you are coming to a negotiation and agreement with your adversaries because you want to avoid that conflict. And so the JCPOA was representative of a diplomatic breakthrough. It was a breakthrough for relations between the US and Iran, creating a detente. On the nuclear proliferation front, it created the strongest oversight of a nuclear program that we've seen. And this is incredibly important. You know, when people talk about the nuclear deal, those who oppose diplomacy, those who oppose the deal, often cite restrictions like, well, it doesn't address other behaviors that we don't like of Iran. And yet that wasn't the purpose of the deal, right? Like we have historically, when the Soviet Union and the United States were, you know, mortal enemies sort of, and during the Cold War, when we were at the peak of fear that there was going to be an actual nuclear war, we still had agreements because what was the purpose of those agreements? It was mutually advantageous because we were trying to prevent something that would, you know, really destroy both our populations. And in the case of nuclear proliferation on a global scale, this is a question of global security. It is one of the existential threats that we face. And like everybody knows, everybody's heard of an arms race, is when you have a region where you have one party or one country that pursues certain weapons, then obviously that makes everybody else want to pursue those weapons as well. And so this deal was so important for the non-proliferation community. Now, remember, something to keep in mind is Iran is a signatory to the non-proliferation treaty, to the NPT, and it is abiding by that treaty. It allows for a civilian nuclear program, which is precisely what Iran has always said that it's pursuing. And that oversight of the JCPOA allowed monitors that made sure that Iran could not have a nuclear weapon. So you hear sort of hawks in the United States always talk about, we, not just in the US, also, for instance, in Israel, saying, we won't let Iran have a nuclear weapon. It's like, well, there was a simple solution to that. We already had that solution. And so anybody who's undermined that solution, you really have to question the talking point of, we want to prevent Iran from having a nuclear weapon.
I want to add something to that. I also want to get into to Trump and the Iran deal. But first, you know, a lot of more hawkish commentators and voices will say, any time that you advocate for maybe more diplomatic relations with Iran, they immediately throw out that, oh, are you a supporter of all the things that happen in Iran? Are you a supporter of maybe the more authoritarian things that happen there? And I wanted you to address that because I feel like it's not necessarily a good faith argument that they make when they bring that up.
No, absolutely not. And you're right. It's not a good faith argument because it makes it seem as if you cannot criticize someone and at the same time recognize that something is good, right? Like it's so black and white. It becomes so absolute that it's really not a logical conversation.
And I would just add to that, I mean, as Americans, I think we can only influence, you know, maybe the policies of the American government. I don't know what we can do to influence Iran.
Absolutely. And this is a point, you know, Noam Chomsky, who's a brilliant man, obviously, has made this point before, where it's, you know, when we talk about, for instance, one of the talking points that we often hear is about human rights. Human rights is significant. Nobody would argue. No one in their right mind argues against human rights, right? No one is out here saying, hey, we don't like human rights. Everybody does. But the issue becomes, what role do we play and what can we do? And Chomsky's point is to say, well, in reality, we can't do very much about these things in other countries. What we can do is not create an atmosphere that exacerbates those rights abuses. What we can do is obviously address our own policies and where we have power. And of course, as Americans, that's where we have power. We have power over our own policies. So for instance, right now, when we have sanctions in place that hurt vulnerable people, vulnerable classes more than anyone else, that have forced middle-class Iranians into poverty, that have impeded the ability of the country to combat a global pandemic with the COVID-19 virus, none of those things are helping, right? We're not helping ordinary people. And so it becomes questionable when our own policies are the ones who are exacerbating those sort of rights issues. And the idea that these policies are helping the situation, there's no evidence of that, right? The human rights situation in Iran has not improved because of sanctions. The behavior that we don't like from the Iranian government has not improved because of sanctions or because of these policies. So it also becomes a question of the efficacy of a policy. It's like, well, even if that's your objective, well, your objective is not working. So we have to start to consider what are alternatives, what are alternative policy positions. And the thing about, you know, this sort of belligerent rhetoric and sanctions on Iran and pressure on Iran is none of this is new. It's been going on for 42 years, right? Like since 1979, that has been the mentality of the United States towards Iran. And yet here we are.
And I also wanted to mention, I think that things like sanctions, I mean, the evidence I've seen is that, you know, they don't really work that well. They cause a lot of suffering. And I think things like sanctions combined with the killing of Soleimani, you know, this sort of approach to U.S.-Iran relations, I think it can create blowback in the future, too.
Absolutely. And we've seen that in other cases, right? One of the sort of interesting things that you always hear people say is, you know, why is Iran in Iraq? And let's start out by saying Iraq is a sovereign country and no foreign power should be in Iraq, whether it's Iran or the United States or anyone else. But the irony of the question is no one ever, like the same person will not ask, well, why is the United States in Iraq? Iran is in Iraq as a consequence of the US invading Iraq in 2003. So we don't look at, you know, we always sort of want to discuss politics in this presentist attitude without looking at the history that's led to that situation. And it's our own decisions, our own policy decisions that have created that sort of environment and the instability that we see in the region. And so, yes, we see blowback from that all the time. We are affected by it. We've now spent nearly $2 trillion of the last two decades on wars that have borne no fruit for the United States. Nothing. We haven't benefited in any way from it. And, you know, the counter argument to the 2003 invasion of Iraq is, but Saddam Hussein was a bad guy. I agree. But here's the problem with that argument. The United States supported Saddam Hussein in the 1980s. So our policies tend to sort of ignore these histories, and you hear this kind of spin in the moment of what makes sense. But in reality, it's because what is the question that has to be raised is, what is the objective of the policy? If the objective of the policy is what's stated, right? If it's to support democracy, to support human rights, to create stability, then we are failing at that miserably. But if the objective is something else altogether, then that's a question that has to be raised.
And I mean, from the perspective of Iran, when we go into Iraq and then start saber rattling immediately thereafter about Iran, they're going to do some defensive posturing. I think that's just a natural reaction to the type of saber rattling we saw in the Bush years.
Absolutely. And one thing to keep in mind, there's like this sort of popular meme that's used that shows a map of Iran, a map of the region. Iran is in the center, and it has, you know, all of these sort of dots around it that are U.S. bases. And the joke of the meme is, you know, who's the threat? Well, I mean, the United States is not surrounded by Iranian bases. It's clearly in the other direction. And what's interesting about this saber rattling, this idea that we, you know, this constant belligerent language, even if Iran reciprocates the language, Iran can't reciprocate in kind, right? You cannot talk about these states without talking about their power dynamics. Right now, Iran is under crippling sanctions, and everybody knows this, including Iran, right? This is why they negotiated the nuclear deals, because they wanted to find economic relief. The United States has the power to do that. Not only does the United States have the power to sanction Iran, what the Trump administration specifically showed by really flexing the full weight of U.S. economic power is that the U.S. on its own can unilaterally do it, meaning it can actually force other states not to be able to trade with Iran either from threat of U.S. sanctions. So to compare the most powerful country in the world that can basically with a stroke of a pen cripple your economy to a country that obviously can't reciprocate that and is the one being crushed is a really imbalanced way of looking at the situation, as if we are actually under threat of Iran in some way.
So with regards to Trump and the Trump administration's policies towards Iran, of course, this administration basically crushed the JCPOA. Relations became much, much more tense. And it's interesting to me that the current special envoy for Iran, Biden's envoy to Iran, Rob Malley, who incidentally was, I believe, the lead negotiator on the 2015 nuclear deal, he says that the way Trump approached this with a maximum pressure campaign really just did a complete number on U.S.-Iran relations and hasn't led to any really good outcomes.
That's the view of the entire Biden administration, right? President Biden, when he was a candidate, relentlessly criticized Trump's Iran policy. Even before Trump pulled out of the deal in 2018, in 2017, Biden released a statement basically saying that such a move would not only be a mistake, but it would isolate the United States and not Iran. All of that became true. The U.S. became diplomatically isolated while, you know, the international community worked to save the deal that the U.S. is still not a part of right now. Secretary of State Blinken last year in 2020, after the assassination of Soleimani, said that while Trump's idea of ending endless wars would be good, we're nowhere close to doing that because, in fact, if there's less stability in the region, if there's less national security for the United States, it's because of Trump's policies. And he calls tearing up the deal the original sin that led to that. So this is shared across the Biden administration. Rob Malley actually, not only has he repeatedly said this, but just today, again, we saw comments from Rob Malley again reiterating that maximum pressure was a failure. and that there's no question to that fact. But the real question now becomes is how, what actual moves will the Biden administration take to distinguish itself from the Trump administration?
If I maybe have listeners that are new to U.S. foreign policy, I have a lot of listeners that are in university, undergrads that are just getting interested in these topics. What does a maximum pressure campaign entail? It basically uses political, military, and economic tools to apply pressure on another country.
Yeah, so the way that it was defined by the Trump administration was mostly through sanctions, right? What Secretary of State Pompeo at the time said is once they were done, it would be the strongest sanctions regime in history. And so the idea was really to isolate the Iranian economy and cripple it to the extent that it could. And they did not relent despite a global pandemic, right? Even though there were international calls that said, hey, well, we're in a global crisis, so we should all be working together to combat that. Still, the Trump administration continued to double down on sanctions. In terms of any other component, well, the assassination of General Soleimani has to be seen within this sort of pressure campaign as well. The attempt to isolate Iran diplomatically, although it didn't necessarily succeed, but the attempt to isolate Iran diplomatically, such as the Trump administration in September of 2020, going to the United Nations to claim that UN sanctions, United Nations sanctions, had all been snapped back. The UN denied this completely, rejected it straight out because it made no sense from the UN point of view that the US would try to use a mechanism within the Iran deal that it was no longer a party to. But it still tried. And so basically from every avenue short of direct military action, that's what the maximum pressure campaign was about.
And if we could stick on the sanctions for a second, I mean, beyond politics, when I look at these sanctions, it doesn't seem to be something that helps the Iranian people. They're violent. They cause starvation. Could you comment on just the really horrible, I guess, ethical issues that arise from these sanctions?
Well, first, let's say that remember that we have historical precedent for this level of sanctions as well, right? And Iran still hasn't even gotten to the place where, for instance, Iraq had gotten to by the early 2000s after over a decade of incredibly strict U.S. sanctions. And there is, you know, a lot of evidence of, you know, the thousands and thousands of people who died due to sanctions, especially children. You know, there's a sort of famous interview with Madeleine Albright where she's asked point blank, you know, 500,000 Iraqi children have died from our sanctions. Is it worth it? And her response is yes. They believe that it is. So in terms of an ethical and moral decision, if you're saying the death of 500,000 children is worth whatever it is that we're trying to accomplish, yeah, that's definitely questionable. And that sentence is sort of like lived to haunt her because of how sort of gross it sounds to say, yeah, we think it's worth it. Now, in the Iranian case, it hasn't gotten to that. It hasn't reached that level yet. But even right now, I mean, there are reports come out that say something like 10 or 11% of the Iranian middle class has been forced into poverty. This is decimating Iranian civil society. It's not helping it. You know, when we talk about indigenous movements in Iran to help their own situation, movements against the repression of their own government, well, when you are in poverty, when you are thinking, when your first sort of instinct is to think about how you're going to live, then it doesn't really leave much room for political thinking. And so we're not helping that situation in any way. The fact that it has exacerbated the pandemic is a huge, huge sort of moral failing on our part. You know, Iran produces most of its own medicine. Well over 90% of the medicine in Iran is produced by Iran itself. But there's specialized medicines that it does not produce. So for instance, the reason why cancer patients in Iran are affected by sanctions is because they don't have those specialized medicines. And so now you have, you know, children, people with cancer who cannot get the medicines that they need. None of this is affecting the Iranian government. This is all affecting ordinary people.
And I wanted to add to that. I remember when I first started becoming interested in university with this subject of U.S.-Iran relations, I would talk about things like the 1953 coup, and people would say, well, that happened in 53. And I would bring these things up in relations to issues like sanctions. And when people would say, well, that was a long time ago, I would say, do you not think that the Iranian people have long memories. I think that the policy decisions we make when it comes to Iran, I don't think these things are easily forgotten by the citizens of Iran.
They're not easily forgotten, and there's a reason. This goes back to power politics, right? Power dynamics, I should say. The reason why we can dismiss certain things so easily as Americans is because we are not really affected by them as much. We're affected more by our own policies because our own government has the power to hurt us in any way. But there isn't really actions taken by other states. You know, if someone asked, when are we going to forget 9/11? That would be a ridiculous question, right? We're not going to. It's a major historical moment because actually it caused damage and havoc and killed Americans, right? This was something that was so dramatic in the consequences that it had that it's not something that would be easily forgotten. But those things are rare for Americans sort of because of our position of power. Whereas when you are the vulnerable, when you're in the vulnerable position, you remember everything because you're still living in that vulnerability. You know, you're still living with the consequences. And when you exist in a certain set of consequences, then it's not something that's easily forgotten.
Now, you've mentioned that the Biden administration and Biden himself, when he was on the trail to the White House as a candidate, you mentioned that he was very critical of the Donald Trump approach to Iran. Recently, you co-authored a piece in Foreign Policy entitled President Biden Must Follow the Advice of Candidate Biden on Iran. What's the difference between Candidate Biden and President Biden when it comes to Iran?
Well, you know, there's a lot of distinctions between President Biden and President Trump. On Iran specifically, there are distinctions as well. But I think one of the things that how can I put this? You know, Trump created an atmosphere where anything that's not Trump is now just, we're just happy. We're just happy something is not Trump. And that's really not enough because we need to go into the details of what these policies are. In practice, the Biden administration has said that they want to do specific things with Iran. They say that they want to return to diplomacy. This has been repeated. But in practice, they haven't actually done anything differently. And by that, I mean the maximum pressure policy, if the crux of the policy was sanctions, which it was, those sanctions are all in place. So how is the policy changed? If you are an ordinary Iranian, nothing has changed for you. Everything has stayed the same. Now you just have someone who says they want to deal with you and they say it much nicer. But that's the extent to which in an everyday existence, anything has changed for Iranians. It hasn't. Whereas candidate Biden was, you know, emphatic about certain points. So for instance, on COVID relief, in April of 2020, Joe Biden wrote a piece for Medium, a statement on COVID relief for Iran during the pandemic. And in that piece, he writes that despite the fact that there are humanitarian exemptions in our sanctions, in reality, US sanctions are preventing essential goods from entering Iran. And he calls on the Trump administration to take, quote, immediate steps to address this because it is the humane and right thing to do. These are Biden's own words. And yet now he has had 2 months and he hasn't addressed those sanctions at all. He hasn't addressed the exact same issue. It's not like all of a sudden the banking situation has changed.
And at the time of your helping pen this piece, I mean, and I think even now, there really hasn't been any direct diplomacy between Tehran and Washington.
There hasn't. And there'll be, you know, the Biden team can argue that they have called for talks. They've agreed to do talks. And it's really Iran who's hesitant about doing it. But on the Iranian side, the argument is, well, we don't, you know, rightfully so, they don't necessarily trust the U.S. This has been a hardliner point in Iran for decades. The U.S. can't be trusted, much like it has been a hardliner point in the U.S., right? Iran,
well, especially after everything with Trump, too. I mean, even more so in a way.
Exactly. And so that's sort of what's missing is if there could be a goodwill gesture on the part of the United States, almost anything, just something that, you know, if not impeding an IMF loan of $5 billion for Iran so they can use it for combating the pandemic, helping to unfreeze assets, Iranian assets, this is Iranian money in South Korea so that they can use those assets to buy vaccines to pay for humanitarian goods. These would be goodwill gestures. You know, addressing specifically, and that's why I bring up the Medium piece, addressing specifically sanctions that impede Iran's ability to combat the pandemic is exactly what Biden called on Trump to do. And yet he hasn't done it himself.
Now, let's address something here, since you mentioned goodwill gestures. The hawks, or more hawkish voices, will say, oh, well, doing something like that is showing a sign of weakness. And I think that is such a weak argument. But how would you respond to voices that make that argument?
I think it's a sign of integrity, not a sign of weakness, right? If you standing by your own word, you know, there's this framing of the conversation now that if we return to the deal, we're giving into Iranian demands. It's a complete rewriting of the reality, right? The reality of it is Iran is a signatory to the NPT, which means Iran is legally, according to international law, allowed to have a civilian nuclear program. The fact that Iran has to have that monitored is Iran giving in to other demands, right? That's Iranian sovereignty allows for them to have this program. And yet they were put under sanctions because the international community led by the United States said, no, but we have to overlook it. And they agreed to do so. That's not an Iranian demand. That's an American demand. That's the demand of the international community that, in fact, Iran is conceding and doing. All that Iran is asking is to not be punished based on the idea that supposedly they're pursuing nuclear weapons. That's what sanctions are. So the idea that we would be conceding something to Iran simply by abiding by our own word is really a twisted way to look at the entire thing. And, you know, this idea that we would look weak, here's the other problem with that. If Biden and the Biden team spent years while Donald Trump was president, criticizing him, but then we continue the same policies, what does it mean of that criticism? It sort of renders that criticism moot. So you said that it was inhumane to have these sanctions in place in this when they have this effect during a pandemic. They're not less inhumane now. They're equally as inhumane. And so if we are to live up to the values that we claim, we can't say that humanity is a sign of weakness. That's just a sign that we have some kind of moral backbone.
Now, one of the really interesting recent developments that has occurred in all of this, at least for me, was Trump's own son-in-law, Jared Kushner, former White House senior advisor, praising the Biden administration for its current Iran strategy. I believe it was a piece in Wall Street Journal, an op-ed he wrote, where he praises Biden's refusal to remove sanctions and, you know, basically calls it a smart diplomatic move to do so. Could you comment a little bit on that?
Well, if Jared Kushner is telling you your policy is good, that's probably a red flag. That's the first thing to just consider, is that's your red flag. When you have the opponents of diplomacy, when you have the people who sabotage the deal telling you that your approach is good, then that certainly should raise some concerns as to what your approach is actually accomplishing. And in Kushner's case, his point was to say that this is sort of the signal that the JCPOA is dead. But of course, that's not the actual position of the Biden administration. And so that's where there seems to be a disconnect between possibly the Biden administration's intentions and the actions that are being taken. And a lot of it is coming from, you know, sort of domestic political pressure, the idea that they don't want to look weak on Iran, because that has been the ongoing criticism. But one thing to keep in mind is while Biden is so far unwilling to take any domestic heat for pursuing diplomacy, on the Iranian side, his Iranian counterpart, President Rouhani of Iran, is taking that domestic heat, right? There was a parliamentary bill passed in the Iranian parliament in November of 2020 after the assassination of their scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. And that bill was meant to be implemented in February. That bill would have reduced certain compliances even further. And what Rouhani did is he came to an agreement with the IAEA, a compromise, yet another compromise on the Iranian end, to show that they're still acting in good faith, right? That they're still open to diplomacy, that they want to return to the deal. But that created a lot of backlash for him, because there are hardliners in Iran, just like there are hardliners in the United States. And so there has to be a sort of willingness, a political will on the Biden administration to take some kind of bold action. Because if the attempt is, we're going to make everyone happy, that's an impossibility. There's no way of making everyone happy. There are people on two sides that are diametrically opposed to each other. One that says we support diplomacy, one that says we should have no diplomacy with Iran. But if Biden is actually looking at his own supporters more than anyone else, There was a poll at the end of February by The Economist that asked American voters about whether or not they favored negotiations with Iran to resolve the nuclear issue. 84% of Biden voters said yes. 84%. That's the vast majority. And the most fascinating part, 54% of Trump supporters, Trump voters, said yes.
I was going to add really quickly, you know, I'm glad you mentioned the Trump supporters, because I think people look at renegotiating the Iran deal and maybe having better relations, more diplomatic relations with Iran, as a Democratic issue, a Democratic Party issue, or a left issue. I think it's much bigger than that. I think there's support for it that is actually across different parties.
Absolutely, because we have heard the phrase, you know, ending endless wars from Democrats and Republicans. They all say it's a great idea. Nobody does it. They all say it's a great idea. So the other, and we talked about this earlier about sort of what was the significance of the JCPOA. The other significance of the JCPOA was avoiding a conflict. It wasn't just resolving an issue, but it was avoiding a much larger possibility of another issue, which is an actual war with Iran. President Biden himself said this when Trump quit the deal in a statement, that we're now on a path, inevitably, of either a conflict with Iran or we have to accept the fact that our adversary has a nuclear weapon. This is the dichotomy to which Biden himself put it. And that's not, you know, the idea is sometimes then that gets taken as that's a threat from Iran. But really what Iran is saying is, well, you're threatening us because we have sanctions in place. They can't just sit idly by. There's this idea that the United States, because it's not taking direct military action, it's not doing anything. But that's not true, right? As we speak, U.S. sanctions are crushing the Iranian economy. That is an active, you know, that's something you're doing. That's having consequences on actual people's lives. So the assumption that Iran will just sit there forever under this pressure is also illogical. They would have to do something, whether it's a diplomatic compromise or something else, to get that kind of relief or figure out a way of going around the sanctions. But to believe that they're just going to sit and be crushed doesn't seem to stand up to logic. No nation state would. Nobody would.
So in regards to this sort of, I don't know, flip maybe, or not even a flip, but it just seems like the urgency that Biden was talking about as a candidate, that urgency doesn't feel like it's as urgent anymore. Do you think that maybe there's something going on where the Biden administration doesn't want to be seen as too partisan? They want to be seen as, oh, you know, we're not just going to agree with everything Democrats or progressives in particular think. So, you know, we'll listen to these sort of Republican voices that are pressuring us to maybe not as quickly be more diplomatic with Iran.
Well, I think within the United States, when we're looking at it, remember that that's still a minority. Remember, if it's Biden supporters or Trump supporters, if it's Republicans or Democrats across the board, Americans have war fatigue. They do not want any more wars. They want to end the wars that exist now. The nuclear issue, obviously nobody wants Iran to have a nuclear weapon because nobody wants anybody to have a nuclear weapon, right? Like, nuclear weapons are bad. This is a sort of consensus that people also have. So to have something that addresses all of those things is widely popular. If we're giving into other voices, we're giving into a very small minority. And I think on the side of the Biden administration, that sense of urgency comes from the fact, I mean, not that they're showing it, but why people talk about a sense of urgency is because there's an election in Iran come June, right? So in just a few, and actually the Iranian New Year, the holidays, Nowruz, are starting this week. And it's on Saturday, which basically means the country is like shut down for about 2 weeks. And then when they come back from the holiday, that's really when they'll start to sort of pick up the election campaigns. And the election is June 18th. So right now you have an administration in Iran that is clearly pro-diplomacy. This is the administration that negotiated the deal. In fact, the Rouhani administration sort of built its entire legacy on this idea of sanctions relief and a negotiated deal with the United States. And so they are really pushing for it because that's what they've wanted all along. But we cannot predict what's going to happen in the Iranian election. It's like you can't predict what happens in any election. We can try. We don't know for certain. And so if you get an administration in Iran that is less, you know, U.S. friendly, less diplomatically oriented, then that can create a lot more complications. Now, that doesn't mean that the JCPOA is dead. It doesn't mean that there can't be a deal. Of course there can, because support for the deal in Iran goes all the way to the top, to the supreme leader, Khamenei, right? This is something that the Iranian state has supported all the way. And so it doesn't mean that the deal is dead. It just means that it's going to be even more complicated than we've made it now. And so it becomes sort of this muddier water that we have to deal with. And the idea of conflict becomes a stronger possibility. So it really begs the question of, well, why aren't we using this opportunity? We have it right now. We have an opportunity to return to the deal. Iran has signaled multiple times, and the US has sort of softened their language from, you know, Iran has to return to compliance and then we'll lift sanctions, to, yeah, we also believe in a synchronized, you know, compliance for compliance. Let's coordinate this to return. But there still isn't a step that's been taken to initiate that move. And where, you know, Iran envoy Rob Malley today said, or in an interview that was released today, said that's why the U.S. wants to talk to Iran. And so that's sort of where the U.S. has the balls in Iran's court. On the Iranian side, it's you have to address something before we talk, because technically speaking, Trump offered to talk too, right? Trump offered talks multiple times. In fact, Trump said that, you know, you shouldn't wait till after the elections because I'm going to be better to negotiate with. So to expect Iran to, or the Iranian government to change its mind, despite the fact that the context hasn't changed, is asking for quite a bit there. Whereas, like I said, if we could rebuild some form of trust through a goodwill gesture, then I think you'll see Iran come to the table and we can get back into the agreement, which is ideally where we should be before there's an election in Iran.
Two more things I wanted to add before we wrap up. First, I forgot to mention this earlier when we were talking about Jared Kushner, but I was really interested in Ben Rhodes, who served as the national security advisor for Obama, a very astute thinker, in my view. He sort of has talked about things like the foreign policy blob in Washington, D.C. He said of this Jared Kushner fiasco, I would take this in the Biden White House as a giant blinking red light that maybe what I'm doing is not right because Jared Kushner is finding ways to praise it. And I think when someone like Ben Rhodes says that, we should really pay attention. The other thing I wanted to mention was a tweet by Joe Serencino of the Quincy Institute. He wrote recently, Iran is the easiest to fix tough problem that Joe Biden has. It's also the one that, if he doesn't fix it, could erupt into a war that would derail his entire domestic agenda. I guess my question after reading that was, why are there so many mixed signals about where we're headed with Iran in terms of our relationship to it? Why aren't we sort of moving on this? It does seem like an easy fix. So what is going on here?
Yeah, and I would second both of those comments, because I absolutely agree with Joe. This is something that is actually an easy lift, right? Like, we have this tendency to make things sound more complicated. And by we, I mean people in DC, right? I'm not in DC myself, but the sort of blob that Ben Rhodes is referring to has this tendency to make everything sound incredibly complicated, but it's not as complicated as we make it sound, right? Everything that Trump did, he did with the stroke of a pen. Executive orders. We're going to leave the deal. We're going to put these sanctions in place. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. It didn't require any votes. He just did it all with executive orders. So in that vein, President Biden can do the same thing. He can return to the deal with the stroke of a pen. And really, the deal serves not as an end. It's a beginning. It was always meant to be a beginning, right? It was the beginning of where we could go in terms of relations with Iran and in addressing regional stability, regional security, a regional security apparatus. All of these things can be expanded upon once we have a foundation. And that's, again, this is sort of like basic logic. This isn't a complicated foreign policy thing. This is, if you don't have a strong foundation, what can you build? You can't build anything. And so the JCPOA serves as that foundation, and we can easily return to it.
I think what's really interesting as well is that Joe also said, you know, that if we don't fix this, it could erupt into a war that would derail Biden's entire domestic agenda. Could you comment on the connection between domestic and foreign policies, because I think people think that they're completely separate, and you've been very astute in pointing out that no, they're not really completely separate.
No, well, they're not. So on the point of the fact that it can erupt into a war, I mean, you can just imagine juxtaposing Trump's four-year presidency, where he avoided conflict with Iran. Now, whether that was his intention is a completely different point, whether it was Iranian patience and that Iran changed its strategy. Regardless, if you just look at it on the surface and you compare these two administrations, if the Biden administration actually gets into a conflict or a war with Iran, then just put that next to Trump. And that's the easiest political talking point that can be used and will be used over and over and over again to talk about the failures of the Biden administration. Not to mention the fact that when you are in a war, yes, your resources get funneled into that war. Imagine the amount of resources we have spent, people, human beings, American service people who have given their lives, thousands, to wars that have gotten us nowhere over the last two decades. Iran is arguably a much, much bigger, could be a much bigger disaster than what we saw in Iraq. Iran of 2021 is much stronger than Iraq of 2003. And so the potential for how far this disaster can go is really unpredictable. And that's the nature of all conflict and war. It is unpredictable. And I'm not going to sit here and pretend that I can predict it, because I can't. And anybody who does is being less than fair or honest, because you cannot predict where conflicts will go. If in 2003 somebody said, by the way, this other thing is going to come out of it called ISIS, no one would have said, 100% we know this is what's going to happen. People could have thought this is a possibility, but we don't know. And so the idea that the domestic and the foreign are related, of course they're related, because as long as our emphasis, right, as long as what we put our resources in is more about extending sort of American authority on other countries, which is basically imperialism, as long as that's what we're doing, we're ignoring our own domestic issues. I mean, people put the, you know, student debt next to how much we've spent on wars. It almost seems like we have resources that we are expending on things that are pointless rather than expending them on our own population. Not to mention the fact that that sort of security mentality that we have, the militarism that we have abroad, we've seen, especially in the last year or so, what happens when it comes home, right? We are seeing this increased militarism within our own police force. We see it in the way that we have reacted in the summer of 2020 to protests in the United States, to American protesters. I mean, you had a sitting senator, Tom Cotton, call for the troops to be called in on American protesters. So these are not separate sort of concepts. And, you know, when you look at attacks, for instance, on Asian Americans, just I think it was yesterday, the day before, we had these gruesome, disgusting attacks. The racialization, the dehumanization of people in the United States is connected to how we dehumanize them abroad. Like, that's what justifies these things. We justify things because we other, you know, Middle Eastern people, the Muslim population, basically anything where we see a conflict, once you dehumanize them, that also has consequences for the way we interact with ourselves as Americans, because this is a diverse country with a diverse population. It is an immigrant country. And so they're not disconnected. They're very much intertwined.
So in other words, it brings militarization home. It drains resources that could be used to address issues like student loan debt and healthcare. I mean, there's that definite connection. Before letting you go, this just popped into my head, and I needed to ask you before I wrap up here. I guess the criticism I always hear whenever you bring up that we really need to do something about Iran, we really need to be more diplomatic, we need to find diplomatic solutions, we need to better our relations, we don't want war, we don't want more conflict. When you say these things and you really say that we need to get Biden to act on those better angels, I hear a lot of people respond with things like, oh, give him a chance, or that's helping Trump. I've even heard people say, you're a Russian asset if you attack Biden. How do you respond to this mentality of if you pressure Biden and his administration as voters who voted for him or supported him, that you're somehow hurting the Democrats, Biden, and helping Trumpism. How do you respond to that sort of argument?
Well, first of all, I think sometimes we get backwards what democracy is supposed to be. No one is beholden to the Democratic Party or the Republican Party or any other party. They are supposed to be beholden to American voters, their constituents. That's the direction that democracy works in, right? We're not asking for favors from our political leaders and our lawmakers. We are making certain demands based on the desires and will of the American people, and that's what they should be fulfilling. And so switching that around, I think on its face is problematic. But specifically, it's really worrisome, right? It's worrisome to sort of sit here and watch as if our political parties have become sporting teams that we're supposed to support absolutely regardless of what they do. And in the same way that that was dangerous for Republicans, right? So many people who were opposed to Trump, now whether they were Democrats or independents or actually other Republicans, so many people who were opposed to Trump criticized Republicans for saying, well, why are you just blindly following whatever he does? It doesn't matter what party he says he belongs to. What matters are his policies. What matters are his words and his actions. And so I find a problem with an inconsistency in our criticisms. If I criticize something that Donald Trump does, and I don't criticize the same thing if Joe Biden does it, then I'm not basing my criticisms on actions or values. I'm basing it on some kind of blind ideological following of one side. And I think that's incredibly problematic. We should hold them equally accountable. And if anything, what we saw under the Trump administration, the sort of undermining of democratic processes, the undermining of discourse, right, just full of disinformation, we play into it, I think, more when we allow that to happen because we're saying, well, you can't criticize anybody because if you criticize them, then that's going to help Trump. And I've tried to make this point repeatedly. Being critical of President Biden is not an endorsement of Trump in the same way that saying we want diplomacy with Iran is not an endorsement of the Islamic Republic. These concepts are not absolute. You can actually be critical of something and recognize when things are good or bad in them because nothing is absolute. It's not so black and white. It is important that we point out the differences between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. They are different. And it's important to note those differences. But it's also important to note their similarities because that's how we change those things.
I was going to say in that regard, ultimately for me, what I tell people is if we do not apply pressure to our elected officials, if we do not make it known, hey, we want diplomacy, we want better relationships that are more diplomatic, we don't want more hawkishness or more endless war, if we don't do that, who is going to apply pressure instead? It'll be the Jared Kushners.
Absolutely. And I think that's a very important point, too. If we're not doing it, then we allow these officials to sort of exist in a space where they assume what they're doing is supported and it's correct and it's the best path because, well, there's no one objecting to what you're doing. If you're sitting in their position, you would think the same thing. Well, these people are objecting, but these people are quiet. So as supporters, in fact, you know, as people who supported Biden on his way to the White House, then it is more important for us to be the ones that hold him accountable to why we elected him. One of which, of many, many reasons, but one of which is to make sure that we avoid another pointless, costly war in the Middle East, which is an absolutely horrible idea with no popularity across the political spectrum of this country.
Well, Dr. Asal Rod, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax Views. If you could, let my listeners know how they can keep up with your work, the work at NIAC. And I always like to end on a positive note. Do you think there's any hope for more diplomatic relations and less of this endless war?
Well, you can check out the work we do at NIAC at niacouncil.org. And I'm on Twitter a lot, unfortunately, but I do it. It's at Asalrad, so at Assalrad. And I am always hopeful, to be honest with you. I know I can come across sort of concerned, and I am, but I'm always hopefully optimistic because I believe in the idea of democracy, right? I believe in the idea that when there is a majority view, if we are responsible as constituents, if we can put the right pressures, then we will get results because that's sort of the nature of why we do this kind of work, why you have activists, why you have organizers. And change happens. Change is inevitable. We've seen it happen. So So I'm always optimistic that we have to keep working at it to get there. And I'm particularly optimistic this time of year when it is, you know, in for Iranians, the thing that marks the new year is the coming of spring. And spring is all about renewal and rebirth. And it's always sort of the time that I think people can be hopeful once, you know, the winter cold is done and everything is blooming again. I know it sounds a little bit like a cliche, but we know that the door to diplomacy is open on both sides. We know that both parties actually want the deal. It's just a matter of the will to take a step to do it. And hopefully the Biden administration, the President Biden, like the article said, will listen to candidate Biden and at the very least address the sanctions that are hurting Iran during a pandemic.
Thank you again, Dr. Asal Rod, for coming on Parallax Views. And I just want to say, personally, reading your work, I recommend all my listeners check out all of your writings on places like Newsweek, Foreign Policy, Responsible Statecraft. You're a very astute commentator, and I highly recommend people check out your writing.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Asal Rod. Once again, I consider her a very worthwhile commentator and analyst when it comes to U.S. foreign policy as it relates to Iran. And I just have to say, I'm particularly proud of this episode and the fact that Dr. Rod could come on and really share analysis that needs to be heard at this juncture. Very, very important and powerful information, in my opinion. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at ParallaxViewsPod@ProtonMail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Rats, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.